Good day, and welcome to the President's Commission on Law Enforcement and the Administration of Justice conference call. Today's conference is being recorded. At this time, I would like to turn the conference over to Director Phil Keefe. Please go ahead.
Thank you, and good afternoon, and thank you for joining us today. I call the President's Commission on Law Enforcement and Administration of Justice to order. On behalf of Attorney General Barr, we thank you for joining us today for this important Commission teleconference meeting. I do hope everyone had a pleasant, restful weekend as we come back together for this week's series of teleconferences. As mentioned last week, we're on track to continue this schedule of conference calls with 3 calls per week through May 18th. And if the operating environment changes in a positive way, which I know we all hope will happen, we'll certainly consider our final meeting of 3 days for the week of June the 8th. At this time, I'd like to ask our Executive Director, Dean Keeter, to conduct the roll call of commissioners.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And before I call the roll, I'd just like to remind everybody that the call is open to the press. And for any members of the media on the call, if you have questions or need clarification on anything, please contact Christina Mastropasqua in the Justice Department Office of Public Affairs. And with that, I will call the roll. Commissioner Bowditch. Commissioner Clemens.
Here.
Commissioner Evans.
Here.
Commissioner Frazier.
Here.
Commissioner Galtieri. Commissioner Hawkins.
Present.
Commissioner Lombardo.
Ms. Lombardo will be joining us momentarily. This is Kim Nierheim on her behalf.
Commissioner McDonald.
Present.
Commissioner Moody. Commissioner Parr.
Present.
Commissioner Price.
Good afternoon, I'm here.
Commissioner Ramsey.
Here.
Commissioner Rausch.
I'm here.
Commissioner Samaniego.
I'm here.
Commissioner Smallwood.
I'm here.
Vice Chair Sullivan.
Here.
And Commissioner Washington.
Here.
Mr. Chairman, that concludes the roll call.
Thank you. Any other announcements, Dean?
No, sir. We are good to go.
Thank you. This week, the Commission will complete the testimony on crime reduction, then we'll shift our focus on Wednesday to a panel on victims and survivors of crime. And just a note, this week is actually National Crime Victims Rights Week, where we as a nation recognize and focus on the impact of crime on victims and survivors. To acknowledge National Crime Victims Rights Week, our Vice Chair, Katie Sullivan, will be providing remarks tomorrow about this and the importance of responding to victims and survivors of crime. Then on Thursday, we'll host the first panel on reentry. But today, we're going to continue the discussion on technology tools and the impact on crime reduction and interdiction. All the commissioners should have received bios and testimonies for this panel. And as a reminder, we'll be posting all of these materials on the Law Enforcement Commission website. Once again, we cannot thank the commissioners and the working group members enough for their commitment and efforts and contribution to making this historic commission's work so meaningful and making adjustments to meet our goals in unprecedented time. On behalf of Attorney General Barr, we thank each of you. As noted on previous calls, we encourage commissioners to take notes during the testimony of the panelists, and then we'll open for questions after the last witness. With that, our first distinguished panelist is Colonel Edwin Rossler, who is the chief of the Fairfax County Police Department and has a demonstrated regional and national leadership role on the topic of body-worn cameras. Fairfax County PD has exceptional data and analysis on the use of body-worn cameras, and I know the commissioners all look forward to hearing from Colonel Rossler about the benefits of body-worn cameras and the considerations that need to be made when implementing and operating this technology. Colonel Rosler, thank you for joining us today, and you're recognized.
Thank you very much, and good afternoon. I just want to make sure you could hear me before I start.
Yes, sir.
Great. I offer my prayers to everybody to remain well and get well, and for all your families and friends. So this is a difficult time. My goal in a few minutes is to provoke different thinking for the best practices for the strategic recommendations for building public trust and successes with body-worn cameras. And I'll briefly cover the concepts of the co-production of policing to be used in the body-worn camera program, stakeholder leadership advisory groups, the competition for procurement for testing and evaluation of body-worn cameras in individual agencies, meeting academic study at the highest levels of rigor to make sure your program is effective before you implement it, during the implementation, and to enhance it in the future, and a project implementation plan, and also truly what the biggest need is the public accountability for community and the police officers in the body-worn camera program. We all know in 2014, there were a lot of officer-involved shootings and other less lethal use of force events in the United States and throughout the world, and it was social media type videos from community members, in-car video, and or body-worn camera footage that went viral throughout our nation and the world, and it started a movement, a watershed movement in law enforcement to hold police more accountable. Unfortunately, when we look back at what happened with body-worn cameras, there were a lot of just quick reactions, mainly from our political leaders in our localities throughout the United States, where a mayor or a county executive or a town manager immediately directed the law enforcement chief executive officer to procure body-worn cameras. So many agencies basically used the procurement process and or available grant processes to quickly purchase body-worn cameras and take them out of the shrink wrap boxes and just to deploy them immediately on the street. And then within a two-year period around 2016, we started to see a lot of jurisdictions have difficulties sustaining their body-worn camera programs because they quickly deployed them and did not use strategic planning and or what I call the co-production of policing model with the community and other stakeholders to develop their body-worn camera program. When I talk about the co-production of policing, it's a model that I've embraced, learning from other chiefs throughout the country as a mentorship with them, is to have stakeholder ownership, whether it's labor groups, community advocates, political leaders, is to sit down at the table and develop these policies and concepts. So when we talk about co-production of policing for body-worn cameras, the first item is to have a policy stakeholder group of community advocates to look at what should be the basic policy for the use of body-worn cameras in your community. Simple things of when to turn them off, when to turn them on, what is the appropriate use of the Freedom of Information Act, and to live up to transparency, to have a predisposition to release information. However, when it comes to body-worn camera, there's a decency element in this. And I found that out during my pilot project where we did have that awful case that we studied in the policy with our mental health advocates and other members of the community. What if you have that adult male that is having his mental episode and he has no clothes on and it's captured on the body-worn camera and he dies? And that happened to us, and it was the goal of the group to have some decency, to work with the family, to have that predisposition to release the video, to hold the officers accountable for their actions or inactions, or to demonstrate that this was not the cause of the police. And we had to work through that, and the policy would held that standard that the community set for us here in Fairfax County. But when I back up to June of 2014 when I started to look at body-worn cameras for my local government, we found that it would be best to competitive bid out for a pilot project. And it took me a little over 2.5 years to finally get the political leadership and the stakeholders through an ad hoc advisory committee to grant me the permission and the funding to have a pilot project. So we used a competitive bid process to get requests for proposals for 3 different camera systems to test and evaluate in 3 different demographic and geographic environments, from an urban setting to a non-urban setting, to see how effective the cameras can work in our different environments in our 400 square miles, and also to understand how this would work. We had the American University come in without charge, which held it to the highest rigors of academic review. There was no money exchanged, and those persons did not have access to any staff or myself, so it wasn't influenced by us. So they looked at how my department was before the pilot project of body-worn cameras, and how it went during the project and how it went after the project, which then led us to understand what our IT infrastructure needs were, what the expectations of the community and the officers were, and how did this work in the prosecutor's world, the public defender's world, the judge's world, and what was the push and pull on the operations of those other stakeholders, and how much would it cost to build out the infrastructure for it to work in the non-police settings. So with that, we were able to itemize the cost of a full program, how to sustain it, how many positions were needed to support it, not only in the police department, but in the rest of the criminal justice system. And we still have that stakeholder group together, and we will sustain that co-production group as we look at it on an annual basis as there's emerging technology, obviously, to live up to our vision statement to ethically lead with our community to prevent and fight crime, which is our mission. Obviously, the cameras are to decrease the amount of complaints against officers, to hold them accountable for the behaviors, at the same time hold our community accountable for their behaviors, to reduce the levels of use of force in a community, and also to keep pace with urbanization. We know we have in-car video, we have cell phone video, we have private videos that we get from residents, businesses, there's license plate readers. So our next strategic goal with the co-production model is to understand how can we now leverage this to meet our vision and mission by integrating everything onto one IT platform as other technology emerges. And all of these were lessons learned from successes throughout the world, and especially failures in other jurisdictions. And the best resource that I have for you, which will be disseminated, is the study by the American University, which goes into detail of everything that I'm talking about and provides you more information. So, again, I thank you for this opportunity, and I pray we all remain safe, and I'll stand by for questions later on. Thank you.
Thank you, Colonel Rossler, for your valued testimony and certainly your service. Our next distinguished panelist is San Diego County, California, Deputy District Attorney Damon Mosler. Deputy District Attorney Mosler is a recognized body-worn camera subject matter expert. We're glad to have him today. Ms. Mosler, thank you for joining us today, and you're recognized.
Thank you very much. My name is Damon Mosler, and I'm a San Diego County Deputy District Attorney. I am the Chief of the Economic Crimes Division. I will discuss the impact of body-worn cameras on prosecutors and the need for standards and training to ease the impact and improve outcomes. Over the past few years, we have seen an exponential increase in the number of body-worn cameras deployed by law enforcement. Public perception and expectation have made it almost essential for law enforcement to have cameras, given the public desire for transparency and accountability. In addition, police departments also utilize them to help them limit liability. What has largely been unforeseen is the impact on prosecutors and the rest of the criminal justice system. These cameras gather a great deal of data or videos that have to be ingested or processed by the court, defense attorneys, and district attorneys. Quite often, law enforcement makes the decision to deploy and starts the deployment without contacting or consulting with their prosecutors. I believe we are now at a phase where virtually every prosecution office has some law enforcement agencies with cameras who are providing videos to them for their court cases. Given the widespread use of body-worn cameras, certain standards should be generated nationally to ensure videos do not go missing or are purged given retention schedules, that officers mark critical sections of the video to make it possible to quickly view those sections, and that agencies work regionally to make collective storage decisions, thereby saving duplicate storage costs. Let's start with making sure that all the videos get to the prosecutor. Prosecutors are required to turn over all evidence they receive from law enforcement to the defense if it's not privileged. The problem with body cameras is that quite often many officers show up on the scene and not all of their videos make it to the case that is submitted to the prosecution team due to videos being mislabeled. This potential missing evidence concerns every single prosecutor across the country. It is important for law enforcement to tag the videos correctly with the case number so that all videos associated with a given case can make it to the court system. Missing evidence can lead to cases being dismissed. If all the relevant evidence has not been produced by law enforcement to the prosecution team, it can and has jeopardized cases. So as you can see, it is critical that not only law enforcement understand the need to get all videos to us, but that we develop a standard for all the videos to be tagged or labeled correctly to associate it with a submitted criminal case. Because of storage costs, law enforcement develops retention schedules to allow purging of cases deemed no longer of evidentiary value. If a video is mislabeled with a case number that is deemed ready for purging, that video gets deleted. So if a video is labeled incorrectly and purged, but was required for a prosecution of a case, the case could be jeopardized. In fact, I know of one very serious case involving the death of a police officer where some videos were not tagged correctly and did not make it to the prosecution team. I cannot imagine a more serious matter than the loss of this case due to missing videos. Fortunately, those videos were not critical to the case, but we had to litigate that issue and it could have jeopardized the prosecution of murder of a police officer. Training on the need and application of ensuring correct tagging is critical. In addition to establishing standards for compliance audits, video tagging would help catch mislabeled videos. Almost every body-worn camera system affords the ability to run reports to try to catch mislabeled videos. This, too, will help prevent the loss of cases due to purged videos or videos never getting associated with a case due to labeling errors. Another area of concern for prosecutors that law enforcement was unaware of is that there is a large volume of videos coming to the prosecution team. So voluminous, in fact, that it's virtually impossible to watch every video provided to us. For example, in San Diego, we have approximately 3,200 police officers with cameras. Last year, they generated over 250,000 separate videos on criminal cases, which turned out to be over 83,000 hours of video, or close to 150 terabytes of data. While we will watch all videos of cases that are set for trial, we cannot view all the videos of cases submitted to us for case issuing. Oftentimes, we have a very short time span to review the reports and make a charging decision. As a practical matter, we cannot view all the videos when we are making these decisions. Since viewing all the videos to make charging decisions is not possible, it requires selective viewing. To improve charging decisions, law enforcement should add markers to the videos to help identify critical points in the video. Most of the camera systems have the ability for an officer to mark certain critical evidentiary points of a video, which can help a DA pinpoint and view the critical part of the case related to the video. With so many hours of tape out there, law enforcement can be educated in their value of marking and then also how to mark a video if we develop standards for this. It will help the officers make the videos more valuable. For instance, a victim statement, a suspect statement, and so on, marked on a video can help assess the strength of the case much more quickly and lead to better case-issuing decisions. In that same vein, if we are putting out training and standards, we should include a best practice segment for creating videos for trial consumption. If we demonstrate how videos are used in court and the impact of good videos, then we can improve the output of these thousands of hours of video. Juries do now universally expect videos. But since most policing is reactive, most crimes will not be caught on the videotape. But what is caught on the video can be compelling if it is presented correctly, showing empathy when interviewing an assault victim, letting a suspect rant and rave when being arrested. all things that show what real policing is can help a jury understand the truth about a given case. What it takes is for both officers and prosecutors understanding each other's jobs to get the most out of the courtroom presentation of evidence. Once an officer sees how a case or a video plays out in court, they hopefully will be mindful of doing their best to capture the reality of a scene, which can be helpful for the prosecution of a case. I believe we can establish standards and guidelines and suggestions for law enforcement to see how to get the best outcome from these tapes to the end user in the courtrooms, whether by certain witness interviews or suspect interview, or even just seeing how law enforcement does its job can demonstrate how good of a job they have done or how hard it was to deal with an evolving situation. Finally, with respect to storage, I understand that prosecutors get a smaller subset of all the videos that are captured by law enforcement. Some estimates are that it's 20 to 25% of all recordings are criminal case related. Those videos are being stored not only by law enforcement, but by the prosecutors and oftentimes by the public defense lawyers. It would seem to me as if we could develop a standard of storage within various jurisdictions to eliminate potentially six sets of videos being stored, given that oftentimes digitally stored materials are the subject of backup redundant storage. Perhaps regional storage conversations and studies to see what is possible to save on storage costs in a jurisdiction will lead to the ability to store more videos or increase the number of cameras out in the field in that particular jurisdiction. I thank you for your time today.
Thank you, Mr. Mosler, for your testimony and certainly your service. Now we welcome the distinguished scientist, Dr. Richard Warder Brugge, who is a senior physical scientist with the FBI to address the use of facial recognition technology. Dr. Brugge, thank you for joining us today. You're recognized.
Thank you, sir. Good afternoon. My name is Richard Warder Brugge, and I am a senior physical scientist with the Federal Bureau of Investigation. I serve as the lead subject matter expert for image and video analytics, which incorporates facial identification and facial recognition. I'm here to speak about opportunities and challenges associated with the use of facial recognition to combat violent crime. In March 2018, local and federal law enforcement officers were working to try and recover a missing child. The child had been missing for 4 months and had a history of running away from foster care and falling victim to child sex trafficking. The investigation revealed a social media image of an adult male who appeared to be the child's boyfriend. This image was searched using facial recognition technology, and a driver license image resembling the probe image was returned. Further investigation of the individual revealed he was on probation. Law enforcement officers initiated surveillance on the subject, which revealed the missing child was hiding in the rear seat of the subject's vehicle. The missing child was recovered. Positive outcomes like this are generated through the use of face recognition every day, and I expect the number of such outcomes will only increase as the technology improves over time. Face recognition can be used in a variety of ways, not just to search for unknown subjects, but also to help verify the identity of inmates before they are released, or to make the forensic examination of seized evidence more efficient by grouping together similar faces found on a suspect's computer. For example, locating victims of child exploitation on a suspected pedophile's computer. Law enforcement uses face recognition primarily for investigative purposes in a variety of contexts. One way is through one-to-many searches. In a one-to-many search, a probe photo recovered by an investigator is run against a gallery of images to generate a candidate list. The probe could be an image from a bank robbery surveillance video, or it could be a photograph taken by a sheriff's deputy of an accident victim lying unconscious on the side of the road. The candidate list can include up to 50 potential subjects. A trained professional examines all of the candidates to determine if any of them represents a viable investigative lead. More times than not, as with other investigative techniques, no investigative lead is generated, and the investigator must look for a suspect in some other way. Last year, former New York Police Commissioner James O'Neill described in a New York Times op-ed how, in 2018, the NYPD conducted over 7,000 facial recognition searches, resulting in over 1,800 investigative leads. So let me put that another way. Every facial recognition search conducted by law enforcement today does not result in the identification of a suspect for further investigation. Experts review a candidate list and determine if any subject is worth investigating further. Facial recognition is a tool, and just like any other piece of software or hardware, the experts who use it need to be trained, which leads to my first recommendation. Number one, law enforcement should require standardized training for any official who would use face recognition technology. The FBI and other agencies have developed such training, which meets standards set by the Facial Identification Scientific Working Group, but more resources are needed to make it available for delivery in person or online for those who need it. Testing has shown that the professionals who adjudicate those candidate lists are very good at it. You will find an article in your materials which documents this. However, we need to develop a mechanism to deliver similar tests on a regular basis to ensure that the people who perform this job maintain their proficiency from year to year. And that's recommendation number two. Develop and implement proficiency tests for the adjudicators. Switching gears, let me speak to another concern frequently raised in regard to face recognition, privacy and the galleries used in searches. Most law enforcement agencies' galleries include mugshot images acquired during the normal process of booking criminal suspects. Some agencies also have the ability to have separate searches performed utilizing states' driver's licenses, identification cards, or corrections photos. Such searches are authorized under the statutes of the individual states, and for federal agencies like the FBI, are documented through individual memoranda of understanding and comply with federal laws, such as the Driver's Privacy Protection Act. In the United States, criminal justice agencies have a duty to examine the privacy, civil rights, and civil liberty implications of their information systems and sharing practices, and to implement policies that will protect the rights of individuals who are either suspected of or victimized by crime. Many agencies are required to publish their findings in the form of a Privacy Impact Assessment, or PIA. For face recognition systems, agencies need to establish clear policies regarding how the systems will be used as well. The U.S. Department of Justice Bureau of Justice Assistance has published guidance on preparing PIAs and has also published guidance for law enforcement agencies interested in developing face recognition policies. That's recommendation number three. Law enforcement agencies need to establish written policies for how they plan to implement face recognition, including the source of images contained in their galleries. A further aspect of this recommendation is that agencies should implement governance policies and auditing to ensure that they are following their documented procedures. This recommendation, I must add, would also apply to any use of commercial face recognition services. It is also recommended, number four, that agencies make it a regular practice to understand the performance of their systems and take steps to improve those systems when necessary. This includes assessing the performance of their algorithm across different demographic groups. There are algorithms which exhibit no measurable differences across different demographics when used in a one-to-many search. Such algorithms should be used if possible for that application. A fifth recommendation is that there needs to be continued support of the National Institute of Standards and Technology for testing of algorithms and people. The infrastructure they have put in place over the last 30 years has made these advances in algorithm performance possible. Let me close with another example. A facial recognition request was received in which the agent requested a facial recognition search be conducted on a juvenile female found on a local website known for human trafficking activity. A facial recognition search was performed and a viable candidate was identified. A lead report was returned to the agent who confirmed her identity. A raid was conducted on the suspected house where the juvenile was being held. In the home, they found five other missing juveniles in addition to the young girl in the lead. The suspect was charged with human trafficking. Face recognition can and does work for law enforcement in a way that protects the public's privacy and civil liberties. I look forward to answering your questions. Thank you for giving me the time to speak.
Thank you, Dr. Brugge, for your valued testimony and your service to our country. Our final panelist today is Mr. Kevin Jinks, who is the senior counsel for the Department of Justice's Office of Legal Policy. I've had the pleasure of working with Kevin on UAS or drones working group for some time now, and he's been such a valued partner to the COPS office toward carrying out our mission for the Attorney General in assisting state and local law enforcement agencies in operationalizing UAS programs. I want to publicly thank you, Kevin, for all that you've done to advise state and local tribal law enforcement on this new technology. It's a privilege to work with you. Kevin, we thank you for joining us today, and you're now recognized.
Thank you, Chairman Keith. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, sir.
Great. Again, good afternoon, Chairman Keith, Vice Chair Sullivan, and members of the President's Commission, fellow panelists, or presenters, rather. My name is Kevin Jinks, and I am Senior Counsel in the Department of Justice, Office of Legal Policy. It's my pleasure to address the Commission's Crime Reduction Panel today to discuss how government at all levels can first use UAS, or unmanned aerial systems, also known as drones, to further our missions, and second, counter the threat posed by dangerous drones and their operators. For some time, the Department has recognized the potential for drones. Drones are changing how we obtain information about accidents and crimes, how we rescue crime victims and victims of natural disasters, how businesses and governments check on pipelines, towers, and other infrastructure, and how goods and services are delivered. Law enforcement and public safety agencies across the country recognize that drones save officers' lives. Over time, drone use will only become more prolific and continue to evolve. Indeed, the FAA projects that the number of small drones used for commercial purposes in 2018, just over 275,000, will more than triple by 2023 to over 835,000. In the face of a global coronavirus pandemic, many countries and some state, local, tribal, and territorial jurisdictions, also known as SLTT jurisdictions, have found ever more novel ways to employ drones, such as monitoring compliance with social distancing guidelines or reaching vulnerable populations to communicate information about where services, food, et cetera, can be found. Thus, the question for law enforcement and public safety agencies is not whether they should have a UAS program. The question is, what kind of UAS program should they have, including oversight and controls? The second question I'll address today is how to build a culture of compliance in our skies to better deter the misuse of drones and better protect the public. I'll summarize the four recommendations for how this commission can assist the department and SLTT agencies answer those two questions. The recommendations are, first, we recommend continued responsible use of UAS by law enforcement and public safety agencies throughout the country, using a number of documents as their guide. For example, the 2019 Department UAS policy posted on the department's website, and best practices collected by our Community-Oriented Policing Services Office, which Chairman Keith also directs. He serves as the director for it. Those documents are also available on the National Institute of Justice's website and the COPS Office website. In fact, the COPS Office just published a collection of best practices from SLTT jurisdictions this afternoon in advance of this hearing. Very briefly, some of those best practices include, just to highlight a few, advocating for use of UAS pursuant to appropriate safeguards and protections for privacy and civil liberties, increased communication and continual engagement with the public, thoughtful and deliberate planning of baseline training required to operate UAS, consideration of cybersecurity and supply chain risks on the front end before acquisition, and finally, investment in a relationship with the FAA. Second, we recommend administration support for a comprehensive drone enforcement criminal statute that addresses the gaps in current authorities to better deter and punish malicious and unlawful use of drones. After careful study and interagency discussion, the department determined that the criminal enforcement tools currently available are fragmentary, inadequate, and insufficient to deter unlawful malicious use of UAS. Enacting a comprehensive criminal provision with adequate penalties can address the most serious and dangerous misuse of drones and deter. Third, we recommend that the administration and Congress chart a path toward incrementally providing SLTT law enforcement and public safety agencies greater authority to mitigate drone threats under appropriate circumstances. What do I mean by that? This would namely be accomplished by an extension of authority under the 2018 Preventing Emerging Threats Act, which empowers the Department of Homeland Security and the Department of Justice and the Attorney General, rather, to counter the threat of UAS by taking certain authorized actions. We recommend allowing an SLTT pilot program in order to protect certain events, such as mass gatherings, special events, critical infrastructure, and airports. We recommend that this be done with counter UAS detection and mitigation technology, the ability to bring a drone out of the sky or take control of it or otherwise prevent it from getting into a place or space. And we recommend that this be done in concert with appropriate federal entities such as the Department of Justice, Department of Homeland Security, and the FAA. Finally, as a fourth recommendation, we recommend that law enforcement agencies collaborate with the FAA to identify the needs of law enforcement agencies and to incorporate those needs into the flight control system that is being set up to manage drone flights in the United States. The UAS traffic management ecosystem is a framework. Inside of that framework, one major component will be Department of Transportation's remote identification rule, which the FAA and DOT is currently working through public comments in response to. Work is ongoing at the federal level to identify our national security needs, and the Department of Transportation and the FAA will need to incorporate and address our concerns on the front end while establishing a rule that is easy to understand and easy to follow. In closing, the department recognizes that law enforcement and public safety agencies must harness the promise of new technology in a manner that reflects the values and rights that we as public servants are sworn to protect. We believe in this discussion of employing advanced technology that there is a balance that promotes accomplishment of our law enforcement and national security goals while simultaneously preserving our democratic and privacy values. Our duty is to identify and strike that balance. Thanks for your attention. I'm happy to answer questions and provide further detail on the recommendations.
Thank you, Mr. Jenks, for your informative testimony and for continuing to serve our country in the Department of Justice after your distinguished career in the United States Army. Thank you again for your service. Commissioners, we're now open for questions for the witnesses. Commissioners with a question, please state your name prior to the question and direct the question to a specific panelist. Or if you want a response from the entire panel, please state so. Just as a reminder to the commissioners, your mics are hot at all times. Thank you, commissioners. Now with questions for our panelists.
This is David Roush, Chief.
You're recognized.
I'm sorry. Chief Russell, a question in terms of it. It seems to me the concept of creating a team to discuss policy on any technology is a good idea. In your experience, who are some of the critical members of the community that you need to have on that team?
Hi, just checking to make sure you can hear me. Can you?
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir. Yes.
Okay, great. Well, it's great to listen to my peers on the call because this co-production process we've used with drones and other technology, including facial recognition. But for me, it's the formal groups, the NAACP, the ACLU. We have a police ad hoc commission that was formed years ago after an officer unfortunately murdered an unarmed man. So I've kept that ad hoc commission alive. It's almost like a consent decree group. We have other local formalized groups called Communities of Trust, a faith group. And then there are those that have tagged along in my career over 31 years here in all different ranks that are in my virtual Rolodex now. That are, you know, they're no friends of me sometimes, but this includes members of the media, the Washington Post, local media. So it's an alphabet soup of people that are pro or anti-police, but we all come to the table. When it came to body-worn cameras, obviously, in listening to another prosecutor, we did have our prosecutor at the table, the clerk at a court, public defender, and obviously through the transition of an election, we kept that stakeholder group alive. So it's got to be a manageable collection of people that are not going to agitate at the meeting, but they're going to be professional. And obviously when they leave, they could agitate. But it was difficult to do that lift years ago on a use of force change because the morale, my union leaders, they didn't like it. But I include them in on this. So everybody has ownership of it. And I think that's critical because when we do have a failure, they're a little bit more forgiven and allow us to get back to the table and say, well, we didn't think about that. And it's a little bit more graceful that they have ownership of it. Hopefully that answers your question.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
Other commissioners with questions?
Hi, this is Katie, and I wanted to ask about body-worn cameras, please. And I'd like to know how you believe or have seen body-worn cameras best leveraged by your agency, and that can go to either of the first two that testified. Thank you.
Hi, Ed Rossley. Could I just understand the first part of your question?
Yeah, like what is the best, that is, where are sort of the pluses and minuses of body-worn cameras on a practical level? Where are you finding that they assist officers and where are they hurting officers? If you kind of had to name the top, the best, worst. Do you understand?
Yes, thank you for the clarification. In assistant officers, obviously it's that rudeness complaint. He said it this way, she said it that way. We could go right to the videotape, if you will. We do have a civilian review panel and a police auditor that's independent of me as police chief. They report directly to our board of supervisors. The civilian review panel, by law in the Commonwealth, they cannot make these documents public, but I do have a predisposition to release videos. And it's to show the good, the bad, and the ugly. And so from the top negative point, the officers do not like it when I release those videos. When I mentioned in my testimony during a pilot project, we had this awful case where a 32-year-old man, no clothes on, was rampaging in his parents' home, and he was having a heroin overdose, and he died. Predisposition to disclose the parents did, and mental health advocates did not want me to release that, but we worked together to release the important time frame to show that the officers did not use force against this unfortunate young man, and we had to pixelate for decency, and that took a couple weeks, but having the media involved in that, if I didn't, they would be beating me up, and that would be a negative against myself and the department and the officers. So that co-production model is reduced the negativity of it from both the community and the officers. So hopefully I give you two good examples there.
So this is Damon Mosler. From the perspective of a prosecutor, we do officer-involved shooting reviews in my office, and the videos are very helpful for that, even if they don't catch everything because the camera's obstructed with the officer's outreached arms. The verbal commands, hearing the situation, hearing the suspect, has been very helpful in understanding what occurred on officer-involved shootings. And then also, in terms of suppression motions, cases where people are contesting the search, whether there's consent, what the officer said, those types of things have been super valuable. Anything that's dealing directly with the credibility of an officer is caught on the camera, and generally speaking, it works out very well for the resolution of cases or us making, issuing, or other decisions based upon that.
Do you, as a prosecutor, do you, what is the downside of body-worn cameras?
Two things. One is juries are going to want to see video no matter what, and we don't always have video that we can play that's going to be of relevance. The other one is policing is not always pretty, and so there are certain things that are caught on tape, sometimes forceful language that can be cringeworthy, that we have to make decisions on whether to go forward or not. In the whole totality of it. But I think that there's not many negatives other than having to deal with the volume of videos and figuring out how best to triage that. The rest of it, it's out there. People are filming all the time with their own cell phones. I'd much rather get it from the police officer's perspective and see how things transpire in the whole picture, not piecemeal from surrounding people who only catch a little bit of something.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Hey, Phil, this is Don Washington. I'll have to follow up from Katie.
Yes, sir. You're recognized.
All right. And I'll have to ask questions of Colonel Ressler and ADA Mosler, if you have an input as well. But, Colonel, you heard the prosecutor talk about the volume of, you know, camera footage that prosecutors have to deal with and all of that. But I'm curious as to how you deal with the volume internally, how much, you know, whether the anticipated cost for storage has met your, you know, met your projections or not, and whether you're having any kind of issues as to, you know, looking forward in time as to how to deal with the increased volume of video, which I think for the most part has pretty good load in terms of storage, a pretty good storage requirement, I should say. How do you deal with that?
So in the pilot project, we did a 3-month pilot, actually a 6-month pilot project at three different stations and involving different operational officers, including some motor officers. And through the academic study, we were able to get the metrics of what this would look like as we push it out to basically an operational labor force of 1,400 people. And we decided to do a 3-year phase-in of the program. And again, this is produced with our prosecutors, public defenders, and the courts to then say, okay, how many people do we need to manage the backside of this, such as field operations? If cameras go down, do we have a network analyst to respond out at 3 o'clock in the morning? How many network analysts does it take to manage as we onboard the cameras in this 3-year phased-in program? The same thing with the clerks at the court and for the prosecutors. So the county was then given a proposal from myself, the Commonwealth attorney, the public defender, all of us at the table, and our advocates. So this is the price tag. This is what we believe, based upon the metrics, will be, and this is how we could do it in our economic environment over a 3-year process. And then we'll use strategic procurement to get the right product that could meet the scope of our IT environment for all the users, not just police, but all the other stakeholders. And also to handle FOIA, I had to increase my Media Relations Bureau, and the county also has a FOIA office. So it had to push-pull. So we identified several dozen positions that will be needed to support this and manage the storage. There is technology available to speed up the video at realistically 4 times where you could still see and hear and or do key searches. And that is something that the Commonwealth Attorney Association in the Commonwealth of Virginia, and I'm sure others, are wrestling with, because they came up with a ratio of how many prosecutors and public defenders they need per 50 body-worn cameras. And I agree with that, and we'll obviously marching through that in a phased-in project. But to keep the co-production committee alive and the academic institution involved so we could measure the metrics and then come back if we made errors, we could adjust and tweak. And if we need more money, obviously I could try to ask for that. Right now with the COVID crisis, obviously, we might see the last phase of our program get delayed because of the economy. But, you know, so far it's going well. So no negativity in these metrics right now. I think we've hit the nail on the head with the help of the academic institution and looking at the failures across the globe.
Yeah, Colonel, do you have an idea of just how much storage you have had to purchase for your body-worn camera system? I assume it's in the terabytes or petabytes, or I have no idea. But you have any suggestions as what you might be seeing?
It's definitely in a terabyte zone, but I'll go back to the strategic planning and the strategic innovative procurement process. We got a wonderful contract for 5 years that we don't have to worry about going over right now. Obviously, at the end of year 3, I'm going to have to look real hard with my peers that are involved in this program at how do we get this contract renewed? What is data storage going to look like? And obviously, for instance, a homicide case, keeping that for 99 years in the creative procurement world to possess and own our data. So you know what? If I decide to go with a different vendor at year five, that's my property, and I'm going to put that on a server farm at my county. So we do have an exit process. If it gets too expensive, we could just store it on our own data farm. We have that luxury, and that, again, is using our procurement leaders to help us navigate a good contract for right now.
And do your officers, I assume, assist the prosecutors in terms of, for example, identifying Giglio evidence and sort of marking that and putting it aside, or is it just send it over to the prosecutor and kind of let them deal with it?
We have a good relationship. We had in-car video before body-worn cameras for well over a decade, so our internal affairs will keep that firewall up with our major crimes detectives on that, and we alert our prosecutor's office when there's an internal affairs case, and we usually get the case continued so they could figure out where to go, and sometimes obviously asking for a scrub team to do it the right way.
And ADA Mosler, in your experience, you know, how do you deal with you know, producing Giglio when you've got the kind of volume you were talking about earlier? Do you just tell the judge, hey, I'm going to do open discovery and there it is, or do you make an affirmative effort to deal with that?
We universally turn over almost every video in every case without necessarily viewing it. Our individual crime units have certain discretion, such as sex crimes and family protection, to view before they discover. But our general crimes cases, unless there's something in the police report that alerts us that there might be something untoward in there, we turn the video over up front. We have a protective order, so that way it can't be disseminated to the public, but we basically say we can't view all this video, and we're not going to try on most of these cases. And law enforcement knows that, because they don't view it before they turn it over to us anyway either. So that's the way we satisfy our Giglio responsibilities and duties. It's not popular. I talk to prosecutors elsewhere, and they are very troubled by that, but they usually don't have as many cameras or as much volume of video that we have. We didn't like doing this at first. We viewed videos, but we wore people out. They were watching hours and hours of video every day, and they're not going to catch something on the video if they're not paying attention, because they can't. So we turn it over videos, open discovery, and then we, you know, before trial, we'll look at it closely. If the defense sees something, if our prosecutors see something, they can't automatically talk to the police department. They have to go through senior prosecutors to evaluate, because some of them may not see the world the same way as someone who's seen a lot of cases, to realize that's just colorful language. That's not a Brady or a Giglio violation. But that's how we're handling it.
Okay. Thank you.
Chief, this is Craig Price. I have a quick question.
Yes, you're working us.
Thanks. I'm not really sure who the question really be related to, but as we talk about body-worn cameras and generally recording as a whole, you know, my agency, we've had in-car cameras for well over two decades, and they're very valuable for a lot of different reasons, and, you know, a lot of hesitancy when we first went to them within the agency, but now they're just a way of life. Does anybody that presented on body cameras today ever see our country being to the position where when officers are having an encounter with somebody that is 100% recorded on audio and video, that there would be some type of alleviate a level of reporting that the officer then has to follow up with back at the office? I'll use a DUI arrest as just a basic example. The behavior of the subject driving, the reason for the stop, all of the contact with the individual is all on audio and video. And then we still have the officer go back, review the video, spend multiple, you know, not hours, I would say, but an hour of time writing a report that's already captured on video when they could otherwise be out there, you know, being visible and enforcing the laws of our state. Does anybody ever see our society making that transition, or would technology ever allow that?
So this is Damon Mosler. The reports that an officer writes are a summary of the evidence to help us make a charging decision, and it's a lot faster for us to read a report than to watch a video or the entirety of a video. So I don't think we're ever going to eliminate reports, but I do believe that with artificial intelligence, the way you see your messages on your voicemail for some smartphones starting to populate with the words, I think that, and in fact I know because I've gone to presentations by some of the body camera vendors, they are working on adding report writing elements into the body camera and having the data come in to that where parts of the reporter are automatically generated through narration while they're driving to the station, that the videos will be hyperlinked to potential transcripts of statements that then a prosecutor could look quickly at and then listen to the relevant portions of it, at least with respect to the videos related to police reports. So I do see that. I see an easing of that over a period of time, probably in the next 3 to 5 years.
Okay, thank you.
Chief Rossler here, just to add, I have not encountered any morale issues with officers still having to do a police report and obviously the video footage. Rather, I'm seeing a positive where they're making mention of the timestamp to defend their actions. Thanks.
Other commissioners with questions?
This is Erica McDonald. May I have a question for the panelists?
Yes, ma'am, you're recognized.
And this could go to any or all of the panelists. My question is this. It seems that when it comes to technology and advancing technology, the government sector, the public sector, seems to always be playing catch-up. We're always a little bit behind the curve. Is there something that we could do to be more proactive in this space, either, you know, some kind of standing institutional change that we could do, or relationships with tech such that we, you know, can see it coming as opposed to always playing catch-up?
Any of the panelists want to respond to that question?
Yeah, Chairman Keith, this is Kevin Jinks. May I be recognized?
Yes, sir, you are.
Terrific. Great question. And I think that we have to be careful in our communications with industry. Obviously, we can't communicate non-public information. We can't give vendors and technology companies an inside line on government requirements without making those equally available to other parties. But I think one helpful step is to freely meet with industry and listen to their concerns, listen to their ideas, predict or gain insight on what is coming out in the market in the coming months, and then communicating that information throughout the department to our five law enforcement components and others who would use UAS and even counter UAS technology. I think that's a huge key, and we have a committee, a counter UAS operational test and evaluation committee that primarily serves that function in the UAS and counter UAS context for the department. So I would offer that as one example. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Dr. Richard Vorderbrugge here. May I be recognized?
Yes, sir. You're recognized.
So the last 50 years have seen an incredible transfer in the development of high technology from government-driven developments to private sector developments. And so whereas 50 years ago, Department of Defense or the federal government may have been driving technological innovation, now in the 21st century, we're seeing where it's the private sector doing that. So to echo some of my colleagues' remarks earlier, it is incumbent upon us to be working more closely with the private sector, but do it in a way that we're not necessarily giving anyone an undue advantage. And a key aspect of this, I believe, is that we need to have standards for the systems that law enforcement are going to use across the board. Within the federal government, we've been trying to work on having the same systems, the same sort of APIs in place, basically making the same target point, if you will, so that no single vendor has an advantage, but also so that every vendor knows what target they're shooting at. And so to the extent that we can help establish common interfaces for our technologies, whether it's video, whether it's any information technology, that is going to be something that is for the benefit of all of law enforcement in the United States. Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Other commissioners with questions?
This is Gordon Ramsey with a question.
Yes, Commissioner, you're recognized.
I was wondering if the panelists would want to touch on the lack of consistency for releasing videos, police-related videos, officer-involved shooting videos, and the controversies that often come along with those, just the lack of consistency across the country.
Mr. Chair, this is Damon Mosler. May I be recognized?
Yes, you're recognized, Mr. Mosler.
Mr. Ramsey, from what I have seen, and I work with BJA in reviewing policies and helping agencies deploy cameras in addition to my duties as a DA, I've seen a transition where law enforcement is beginning to understand that they're probably going to want to release this proactively. I think there's always been a reluctance to give up videos or evidence by law enforcement and certainly by prosecutors. But I do see a trend that that is going to change, and I think for several reasons. One, I think it's a responsible thing to do. My mind has changed on this in the past 4 years for sure. But I also, the inevitability of video being released with so many citizens having videos, I believe that it's the more responsible thing for the chief or the agencies to send the message and show what they're doing. And you see Los Angeles Police Department change their mind over the past couple of years. They were absolutely never showing a video, and now they put out high-quality production. So I think we're going to see a change, and I think it's just going to be something that is driven by the region and the populace of the region demanding it, and you'll see that happen.
Mr. Chair, Ed Rossler here. May I be recognized?
Yes, sir, you're recognized.
This is a topic near and dear to me because back in 2013 when I took over as chief, a few weeks in, we had this awful shooting case, and obviously we've seen this debate in Ferguson, Missouri, and so the predisposition to disclose, which I agreed upon with my community and my elected officials years ago, the nuance in this is to protect the integrity of both the administrative and the criminal investigation before a release is done. I don't fully support releasing immediately because you have a criminal and an administrative investigation to do on these real sensitive events in the community. So we need some sleep cycles for both the victims, the officers, and the witnesses that are involved. Obviously, the video records one view of it, but when it no longer erodes the integrity of an investigation, then you should release it fully. And I got caught in that event with the United States Park Police where my video captured the officer-involved shooting. And we agreed between the Park Police Department of Interior and the FBI that this would not erode the integrity of anyone's investigation. And that is something that was a hard sell with my community, but they've agreed upon it because now they know in the cadence that it will be released. But nationally, we don't have a standard recommendation. We need some work there.
Thank you.
Other commissioners with questions? One more time, other commissioners with questions?
Chairman, this is Commissioner Frazier. Can I jump in there for just a second?
Yes, sir, you're recognized.
I'm gonna tag on to that, what he just said about the releasing of the video. I worked on our dash cam bill here years ago through our legislation to get it passed. Took a lot of heat from the officers on working on that. It turned out to be a tool that saved many officers' careers. And we came back and then wrote the body cam bill with our state legislation and our Senator West here. who is a Democrat, but he's worked on both bills with us and did an outstanding job. The buy-in on the bill, on any kind of legislation that you pass on these, is that you have to have, and I heard somebody say it earlier, ACLU, we had Mothers Against Police Brutality. You have the folks that are the conspiracy folks that don't want any of the privacy rights. You have all those groups come together, and most of all the association and unions on board to get these passed. The difficult thing on this, it's not uniformed it's uniformed across our state, but it's not uniformed across our nation. And the biggest problem is the releasing of the video while the investigation is still going on. There's so much critical information there that needs to be kept in-house at the moment per the investigation that's released, because you've got an ANSI chief or you have an ANSI mayor that wants it out there immediately to get it off his back is part of the problem, and the investigation gets compromised. Or you put a lot of officers' lives in danger, or even victims, their witnesses to it. So that's one thing that's not uniform that we really need to look at. Our bill here has been a blessing. We didn't have much pushback from the officers at all, especially with our younger officers. They really wanted it. They feel that it's a protection as they go out there in the field, that they're going to get a fair shake, especially in the day and age with phones, and they're getting videoed anyway. I know somebody else said that earlier, but at least it's from the police officer's perspective when this is happening. And one other thing that we put in our bill that was a little tough to get passed, but we got through there, is our officers are allowed to review that video before they make a statement. Because there's always that angle or that time. I've been in 4 shootings, and I can tell you that you're going to miss some things. You will not see what happened or remember what happened. And that video really refreshes what's happened out there at the scene and lets you tell the story. The story's going to be told anyway. It's already on tape. So those are my 2 cents. I think our bill's really good, and I think it's something for a lot of states to review.
Thank you, Commissioner. Other commissioners with questions? Hearing no further questions, let me close by thanking our panelists once again for your time and most valuable testimony and the responses to the questions from our commissioners. On behalf of the Attorney General and his leadership team of Rachel Bissick and Jeff Vita and all the commissioners, your contributions provided today are most sincerely appreciated and will assist the commission in their deliberations and work. Before we close, just a reminder that our next 2 hearings this week will be on Wednesday, when you'll hear from victims and survivors on crime, as well as remarks from Vice Chair Katie Sullivan. And then on Thursday, when we will complete the week with a panel on testifying on reentry. Also, please check the President's Commission page for additional updates of documents and information on the Maine Justice website. And we will update it regularly as information becomes available. We want to thank the FBI for their continued support for providing their teleconference network to the Commission, and certainly all the federal program managers working behind the scenes to support the efforts of the Commission. Are there any questions or comments from commissioners?
Mr. Chair, if I may, David Roush.
Yes, Commissioner Roush, you're recognized.
I just would like to ask if there's a possibility, and I know we've gone over today, but if there's a chance to schedule an executive session. I have a question about some commission business that I think I would like to get out to the rest of the commissioners, and would like to have that opportunity to have an executive session to discuss a concern.
Yes, sir. We'll get that on the agenda for discussion.
Thank you.
Any other commissioners with questions or comments? If there's no further business before us today, the President's Commission is adjourned. Thank you again, commissioners, for your dedication and commitment.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Phil.
This concludes today's call. Thank you for your participation. You may now disconnect.